The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Is Business Action on Climate Change Believable?, was recorded at Amnesty International UK, London, in January 2016. Here's the chair, Guardian journalist Carl Matheson.
Hello and welcome to tonight's event, Is Business Action on Climate Change Believable?, by Nordea Responsible Investment. I'm Carl Matheson. I'm a journalist on The Guardian's Environment Desk, and I'm joined by a wonderful panel, Catherine Garrett Cox, who's the CEO of the financial services company Alliance Trust, Caroline Lucas, who's the Green MP for Brighton and has also served on the boards of several environment NGOs, Steve Howard, who's the head of sustainability at IKEA, Kevin Anderson, who's a professor of energy and climate change from the Tyndall Centre in Manchester, and Sasha Beslik, who's the head of Nordea's responsible investments body, which has recently blacklisted 40 coal companies from their portfolios. So they're working towards a sort of more sustainable portfolio. I wanted to start with you, Steve, and just ask you, how often are companies failing to meet these types of commitments that were made in Paris?
If you make short-term actionable commitments, most companies are pretty good, probably, especially public companies, are delivering on those. The thing, I'm a bit sceptical about companies when you set a target for 2050, because, you know, it's so far into the future. You're multiple business leaders into the future. But the short-term actionable targets, then there's probably a pretty good success rate. I think there's a higher level of scrutiny now, and certainly many of the businesses that we were involved with, something called the RE100, part of this We Mean Business Coalition. And there's now, I think, 53 or 54 companies that have made commitments to 100% renewable energy. They're all very public. There's an NGO advisory board. There'll be scrutiny that there. And I talked to many colleagues in business about that, and people were very, very thoughtful. And there were intensive processes internally within those companies to say, are we making commitments we can genuinely deliver on? So, yeah, will some companies fail? Absolutely. And I think we need companies to be held to account on these things. So we need civil society, we need media to look at them. But we also need the pressure on the companies that aren't making the commitments. You know, I think that's, rather than sort of look at, say, oh, you know, there were however many, 400, 500 companies that made commitments for Paris, and say, you know, do we trust them? Well, a valid question, but let's say actually the you know, 60,000-70,000 businesses that didn't make commitments to Paris, why have they not made commitments? And what are they doing? And do they have plans and actions? And are they transforming their businesses? And let's I think there's a fair thing, which is for business and civil society to say, let's reward the businesses that do well. We can have name and praise. And we can also have name and shame. And there are a lot of the business community that's still lobbying like mad for the status quo, lobbying vigorously against action like a revolving door, and it's time to call them out. And I think that's, you know, this sort of, we need to say that this is, I think the business community has been seen as one homogenous group, and it's not. It's just composed of, it's very, very diverse, it's very heterogeneous, and we need to look at it in that light.
Catherine, maybe specifically with these companies that are making commitments, take your point that when it's not all one sort of homogenous mass, but Catherine, with these organisations that are making commitments, do you see as a kind of investment holder in them, as a shareholder, that they're living up to their commitments?
Well, I think that we've made progress, but it's not enough. I mean, actually, Steve and I were speaking earlier today, and I think the great sadness is that 2015 could be a tipping point year, if you think about what unfolded in terms of the SDGs with, I mean, whichever way you cut it, 17 goals, 169 targets, you know, very many of them are tied to climate change and what we need to do as a global, should we say, as a global community to do something about it so that the world is not completely broken for our children and grandchildren. But I think, unfortunately, too often people are still paying lip service to some of this. And, I mean, it's really interesting because as investors, where we specifically have embedded a focus on climate change and what are companies doing to address some of the big global issues into our investment philosophy and process, it's fascinating because so often we sit down with CFOs and CSOs and they say, this is a really novel conversation. And that's quite concerning because you would think that as a global investor, everybody should be asking companies not just, you know, what are your margins going to be, what are your top products going to be, but what is the inherent risk in your business that you are running by not addressing some of the issues, whether it's climate change, natural capital, social capital. You can talk about all of these factors. So in a way, it's quite nice being bold and out in front. The scary thing is when you look around, everyone's quite far behind. So I think that there is a lot more that we can do. And I think as an investment community, we just need to probably corral a bit more together because it is the same old names in as much as the conversation Steve and I had earlier, which is it's the same old corporate faces. I think if you said who's really leading the charge around some of these topics, you could probably on one or maybe two handfuls highlight the CEOs who've really done it. And quite often I hear in the investment community that they get a lot of grief for focusing on the wrong things. So I think the business case really does need to be made. And in our case, you know, we think quite long and hard about this issue, but I can tell you that we've spent a long time mapping our investment process and philosophy and binding that into the stocks and companies that we like. And we know that our portfolio emits about, on average, 75% less carbon than a relevant benchmark. Now, I would like to think that this group of people cares about that and think that's a good thing. But I can tell you when I sit down in front of many mainstream investors, their eyes glaze over and they say, yeah, well. But if we then sit down and say, and the returns are much better than the benchmark, then you get their attention. So I think that it's about trying to corral people. I think it's marshalling good business with an investment community that will give companies credit for it to encourage people to be bold and outspoken on some of these issues.
Sasha, you might want to respond to us to this same question. You're working
field. I think you've addressed most of the challenges, but I think what's important to say that our industry, financial industry, has been wrong for about the last 25 years in terms of how we evaluate underlying assets, in terms of the challenges we have ahead of us. I think one of the biggest problems for us as representatives for financial institutions to take this into account in sort of a real way is the time scale that we are expected to deliver returns on. Most of the corporate responsibility issues, sustainability issues for the company, unlike IKEA, who are publicly listed, they will maybe materialize in a period of time between 3 to 7, sometimes even longer period of time. And I'm talking about years, not months. We are evaluated on a yearly basis, which means that even if we change our valuation models, which we would like to do because we think that these risks are material for investments, we need to prolong and change the way how the investments are evaluated, not only in terms of time, but also how we integrate these issues in daily investment decision-making process. This is something that I think, I mean, going back to the lip service, yeah, there is a lot of lip service around, and it's going to be a lot of lip service around. The big question for us is that how do we find a way to validate the commitments that have been made by the companies during the COP21? There is no governance body around the world. You have investors who are maybe to some extent interested in doing the evaluation of these commitments, civil society, media. But I don't know how many resources media have to evaluate commitments of a global company on the absolute CO2 emission reduction targets they have for the 2020 or 2030 when their annual revenues are measured on an annual basis, on a yearly basis. So there is an embedded conflict in the economic model, financial model that we are deploying in order to address this. And I think this is a bigger problem than just a business having a lip service sort of a thing. It's the way how we operate market economy in general that is hitting the wall of the climate to some extent. And we all agree on that, but we are still acting as if there is a business as usual.
Kevin, we actually spoke in Paris, and you described yourself almost as a climate pessimist, I think. In that you really think that we've probably blown our chances of getting below 1.5 C, possibly even 2 degrees C. And you've made that assessment by sort of looking at the evidence and looking at the policies, the financial flows, the technologies we have available. But where does the corporate sector fit into this? And are they feeding your pessimism, or is there kind of some reason for hope in that sector? Where do they sit?
It sounds like I'm going to be picking on the commercial sector. I mean, we can pick on any sector. We can pick on commercial sector. We can pick on industry. We can manufacturers. We can pick on the public. We can pick on journalism. We can pick on governments. We have all fundamentally failed. Those of us that are the emitters. Remember, there's only a small percentage of the global population are principally responsible for climate change, and we have chosen to do nothing about it for a quarter of a century. So the first thing we have to do is, I think, before we even think about these issues, is to hold our head in shame for a few minutes and just remind ourselves. The first IPCC report came out in 1990, 25 years ago, a quarter of a century ago, which is longer, I think, than some of you here have been alive. Since then, we've done nothing on climate change but watch our emissions grow. The emissions this year will be 60% higher than they were in 1990. So we've had a quarter of a century of pretending to care about climate change. That's true for the corporate sector, for the academic sector, for the journalists, for the public, across the board. So the first thing we need to do is a bit of reflection on that. Why is it we have fundamentally failed to address this existential problem? The next thing I think then is, then we are not going to solve climate change unless the commercial sector, you know, comes on board. The private sector, the markets, whatever, however you want to phrase it, they will have to be a fundamental part of responding to climate change. But there are two bits I would suggest to that. Firstly, I'm not a great fan of targets. I like obligations, and I'd like to be legally binding. I like to call them duties or obligations rather than targets or goals. We all set targets and goals because we set them to lose, to miss them. That's what we mean. But if they're legally binding, then someone can take us to court. So let's see companies who really think it's important actually making some sort of structure that allow people to actually say, you haven't delivered on this, here's the fine. So let's try and see, would that help? Would that help also with governments, of course? And governments have not our pledges from government are, again, voluntary. All of these targets are voluntary, and we know that we're going to miss all of these. The next thing I think is a real challenge is that we're not prepared to face or accept the scale of the challenge that's now upon us. And I think that we have left it so late, it begs profound and fundamental questions about how we run our society, at least in the short to medium term. Once we've got low carbon energy supply in place, once we've got lots of, you know, wind turbines and solar panels and possibly nuclear power, maybe carbon capture and storage, once these sorts of things are in place, which is going to take 20 or 30 years, we can go back to the current model we have now if we want to. There are broader sustainability concerns. But from a climate perspective, once we've got a low carbon energy system in place, it doesn't matter so much. The problem in the interim is that our carbon emissions just keep going up. And if you really look at the numbers underpinning our commitments on 2 degrees centigrade, forget 1.5, it's just a sop to poor countries. At 2 degrees centigrade, let's be clear about it, we'd be lucky if we hold to 2 degrees C, and 2 degrees C will kill many people around the globe. There'd be poor, low emitters, typically non-white, living in the southern hemisphere. And broadly, if we're honest about it, none of us here really care that much about it. We're not prepared to make profound changes to our lives. But we are talking in terms of climate change about fundamental, profound changes to how we run society in the short to medium term whilst we put low carbon energy in place. That means we have to cut back on how often we fly, how much we consume, the size of the houses we live, how powerful our cars are, how often we drive, how often we use public transport. These are fundamental changes to how people like us, I guess most of us here, I don't know my typical Guardian audience, but my guess is we're probably relatively wealthy, that people like us have to make profound changes to how we live our lives in the short term if we want to hold emissions down. And that, of course, is challenging for companies because that means they can't sell as much. They've got to sell things that are durable, that are low carbon. They can't look at growth as being a prerequisite of what they do in those companies. You know, this is not an agenda we're prepared to discuss at the moment. At the moment, we're talking about, you know, about the 20th century and not very much climate change, not the 21st century and lots of climate change. So at the moment, I think we're not even prepared to address the scale of the challenges that are in front of us. That was the upbeat story.
How does that play in the boardroom, Steve?
You know, we've had... I used to run an organisation called the Climate Group, and I was saying to... I'm not a climate scientist. I've got a PhD in environmental physics, though, and so I do climate science, and I obsess about it maybe as much as Kevin, but I'm not sure. So my boardrooms used to it, really, and they hired either the wrong person or the right person for that conversation. I still think that I like your shock and awe of what you say, but Kevin, and I think it's a stark reminder for us of the pace and scale that we need to do. I think we need to change the business community needs to change its narrative on this. So let's say business tends to talk and be anti-regulation, and actually, let's say many things we want a well-regulated environment to operate within. And I think business has to take a stand and say we want strong policy. We want carbon taxation or carbon pricing. We want, we want incentives, but we also want really, really strong, enforced, legally binding targets. And we want the business community to be held accountable for that, for their part of it. And then that drives action. And you can invest against it, and you can put people against it, and you can drive solutions. And I think we need to, and let's say in our collective action failure, which you called very admirably, then there's the regulators in the mix there that have underdelivered, and then there's the business community, and then the culpable public. I do think that business has a far greater responsibility than individuals. You know, collective action problems are fundamentally disempowering because we all need to act for us to all benefit long term, whereas businesses have far, far greater influence. I mean, we have 2 million customers a day visiting IKEA. We have far more scope for action. If I look at what we've embraced, I think maybe I will get you by train if you're willing to come over to do some shock and awe for because you're a more salutary and sharper messenger than me perhaps for on my board. But we've looked at how do we change the business at scale and at speed, and we've looked at what we can do. So we said by 2020, and this speaks to your how do you fail on targets or succeed, by 2020 we'll be 100% powered by renewable energy that we own and operate ourselves. We've invested 1.1 billion into wind. We own 23 wind farms. We missed our 2015 target by about 2 months, but we said we'd be 70% powered by 2015. We underachieved because our largest wind farm came on power a little bit late, but now we're at 76%. I'll give us a pass on that as a target. We've installed nearly 1 million solar panels. We committed in June alongside the Bonn climate meeting. We went into the finance session and said, we'll put additional billion into climate action by 2020, 600 million additional for renewables and 400 million from our foundation to help the poorest communities adapt to climate change. The 400 million is pure philanthropy because we can as a business, and it's beholden on us to do it. We said 4 years ago we'd flip our lighting business from halogen and CFLs. It's a 20th of our overall business. It's a big business. We said we'd go 100% for LEDs, which last 25 times longer and are 85% more energy efficient than the halogens. By 1st of September that last year, we were 100% LED sales. We sold 63 million LEDs last year. Over their lifetime, they'll save the energy emissions of a country like Ireland.
Well, I want to ask you about your...
Yeah, go for it.
Your lighting in a little bit.
I jumped the gun.
No.
My enthusiasm for lighting.
Absolutely.
Are we perfect as a business? No, but then you've got to... I think you can drive change when you say, this is the reality... The future of the world is carbon free. How do we make sure our products are carbon free? How do we make sure our investments are carbon free? And go for it with pace and scale. In a well-run business, frequently you can do that, and you can create commercial growth and new opportunities, and it's exciting and motivating. Many sectors can't, and it's dependent on leadership, and you can't leave this to voluntarism.
I think we need to jump in here now. Is that okay?
Absolutely, please.
Because I think what you said is so interesting, but in the same time when you do it, you're not offering or presenting a new narrative. What is the world we want to live in? I'm not talking about IKEA in particular, I'm talking of what you stated just recently, which I completely subscribe to. I think it's fantastic. It's the failure of the system and how we fail and all. But what is the new narrative? Where are we going from here?
But who's the we in that narrative, for a start?
We talk about global society in general, because the market economy is offering, fortunately or unfortunately, solutions that are based on a short terminus, and I completely agree to that. But what is the narrative of the new something we are to work for, which is not only a carbon-free? What does it mean for an individual on the street? We're going to, 2030, it's going to be a carbon-free Nordea or IKEA. What does it mean?
I think we're looking for the meme. If we're looking for meaning within physical products, I think that's a mistake.
Consumer.
What? If I ask people here, all of us here, include us in the panel, what's the most important thing in our lives? We would not tell us an IKEA sofa, or a painting on the wall, or my motorbike, or whatever it might be. What we would say, it's our children. It's the fact that I like going rock climbing at the weekend and spending time with my friends. I like a good real ale down the pub from time to time. You know, these are the things that we would describe as important to us in life. These things don't have any numerical value. They're not related necessarily, certainly not directly related to having to buy goods.
It's a free real ale.
Homebrew. So I just think that we have to remind ourselves that if we are going to solve climate change, a lot of that is about a value structure, a change in the value structure. The problem we have, I think, is that to deliver that change in the value structure can take quite a long time. And whether we have the time frame for doing that, I think, is a different issue. But I don't think it will take any longer than necessarily the technical changes or the product type changes. So I think we have to ally both of those. There's things we can do with technology, huge things to do with technology. And as an engineer who used to work on oil rigs, I think you can do a lot with technology. But there are also lots of things that we can do about reinterpreting how we value the world, actually looking just deeper as to what is really important for us. That's a narrative. Those two put together, I think, provide a narrative.
But, it's better that you take it over, because otherwise we'll have this discussion for a long time.
Well, I'm kind of lost to it. I was caught up in it myself. I wanted to ask Catherine, though. IKEA, in some ways, is an exceptional company because you have a kind of figurehead as a CEO who's open to this. And I think there's other companies that aren't, and you're speaking to those CEOs. And I just wonder, is it a kind of prerequisite to getting these big corporations on the right track to kind of turn the head of one person, or are there other ways of engagement?
Well, I think coming back to the shock and awe tactic, which was really good that you deployed. I think part of it is too many people in the corporate sector have been in denial. I mean, I don't think it's particularly great when you've got a candidate who's running for the United States presidency to stand up and say climate change is rubbish. I mean, this was reported, widely when I was over in the States, and people almost can't believe it. But I can tell you that within the last 12 months, I've had conversations with CEOs of major corporates in Europe, and they just say, it's not real, it's not something I should be bothered about. So I think the short answer to your question is yes. The longer answer is, how do you get there? And I think there is something about safety in numbers. But I think ultimately it's about leadership. I mean, like many things in life, and that's actually why in my introductory remarks, I referred to, do we actually want, to your narrative question, do we want a more sustainable future for our children? Now, exactly what that looks like, I think, who knows? Because 2030, 2050, in a way, decisions we make today will determine whether there are bees in the English countryside, will determine whether there are still cliffs to climb or trees to climb to the top of, or whatever it is. So in a way, choices we make today will roll out. But I think the scary thing for me and for us as investors is that, frankly, not enough discussion is happening at the boardroom in terms of, is this a risk at all? Now, if you walk into most businesses and you said, what's at the top of your risk register? I will bet you it's not climate change. It will be something really dull, and I'm sure really important. But climate change will be right low down the list, unless you're a very enlightened organization for whom perhaps you're heavily operating in this space.
Carolyn, we might ask you a couple of questions just to sort of get you...
Warm me up.
...involved. Yep. I know that you've done quite a lot. You're probably, out of anybody on the panel, you've done a lot of work engaging with NGOs, green groups, the green movement in general. And a lot of these NGOs, these green NGOs, are the ones that endorse or oversee commitments made by corporations on the environment. And so I'm interested in what your take is on whether they then come back and check up on the progress, or do they spend resources? Because, of course, the announcement gets made, the green groups kind of get a kudos and they get a big scalp, and it's not particularly in their interest if it falls up or falls to pieces necessarily. So I wonder how is the checking up done, and do they kick up a fuss when things fall to bits?
I think I would ask whether or not it's the job of NGOs to be doing that kind of scrutiny. It is a huge amount of work to properly scrutinise whether or not policies are being met, whether or not governments are following up on pledges that they make. And that was why organisations like the Sustainable Development Commission, the SDC, were so effective and so good, and why, of course, one of the very first things that our lovely David Cameron did was to abolish them shortly after coming to office, because they were rather too good at it. And this is a government that doesn't like scrutiny. And that's part of the trade union bill, it's part of the whole way in which it's going about its general green policies. So I think it's maybe not fair to ask the green groups to be doing that in depth. You know, I would like to see a reconstituted Sustainable Development Commission, or if not that, then I sit on the Environmental Audit Committee. We meet weekly, but even we don't have the resources to properly follow that up. But, you know, maybe the National Audit Office could be seconding more of their staff over to properly do that. So I think in a way, it should be the politicians who are really holding government to account. And yes, the green groups do a fantastic job and can absolutely put things on the agenda, get public momentum behind them, without which nothing much will happen. But I just wonder if it's entirely fair to put the responsibility on the green groups to be then following up to see exactly what gets done.
May I make a brief comment, just sort of following on from that, Caroline? Because I think that actually, I think in a way this is part of the problem, because people say, well, whose responsibility is it? And everyone's doing this. So one of the things we found as a practical positive step is for us as a business, as an investor, to collaborate with some of these NGOs, which we've done, whether it's Greenpeace or Global Witness or whomever else. And what we've been able to do is to shift the dialogue on beyond a sort of, in some cases, overly emotional rhetoric into something that you can then practically go to organizations and say, we're coming at this as both an NGO with a specific point of view and an agenda, and a business because we want to invest in you and support what you're doing. And when you join up the dots, it can be very powerful. Mm. And I think perhaps actually that's one of the ways, to your point about, is business doing enough and what's the answer? It's about building successful coalitions, because I don't think there's any one silver bullet that will address, you know, that the issue that we absolutely face today. And I think in the past, it's been too siloed. And I think that, frankly, people just need to step up to the plate and recognize that it's just not their personal responsibility or their organization that will make the difference. It's about finding safety in numbers, as I said. It's about building successful coalitions. And it's about moving that dialogue on beyond the do you know what you're doing, and actually putting into, if you don't get this right, the risk that you'll be running to the sustainability of your long-term business model is going to be seriously under scrutiny. And I think people at the board level, around the boardroom table, want to ensure that they leave a legacy behind. So I think we've found that to be quite successful. It's just about finding the right people to do the tie-ups with.
And I think, going back to the narrative thing, that's about creating the new paradigm, is to draw the narrative together. We are sitting in the same boat, and we are pretty much aware of it, although the South and East and West are in a different position depending on our capital requirements. So, and I understand that, but I think we are in a position. 2016 for me is basically a year where we find new ways how to collaborate with each other, how we can actually paint the narrative that we want to strive to in order to achieve that. And that's where we need a politician. I mean, politicians have done a part of it, but I think the business, going back to us, business and financial community not necessarily want the same things. So we need to be clear on that one as well. But I think, speaking on behalf of financial community that I represent, I think it's quite clear for us that we want to be a part of the solution going forward, and we want to make our investments to serve the society in the long term, and that means that we need to reevaluate how we do things. But we can't do it alone. I'll just give you an example. In Odia, we made a decision to postpone or, let's say, expand the range how we evaluate returns in our funds from 1 year to between 3 to 7 years. I meet institutional investors, big institutional clients, who will come back to us and say, yeah, all of that is fine and long-term sustainable. What is my return on a one-year perspective? So I'll meet the retail clients. Nordea has 11 million retail clients. I will ask them anonymously on the phone if they're interested in sustainable investments. Would they choose these type of? Yes, of course. When we come to the sort of decision-making process, when they need to make decisions, they don't do it. And that's why I'm talking about that we need to go back in terms of the creating. What is the actually what we want to achieve? We live in a consumer hypocrisy society. We are hypocrites, all of us, because when it comes to the end, we make decisions that are not as sustainable as they could be because we live in a very egocentric type of the world. So back to what you said, market economy, very egocentric, sustainable development and collaboration is a very collective thing. And this is something that maybe we forgot how to do.
I think we're underplaying the role of government. I don't expect all companies to voluntarily suddenly see the light and altruistically go forward and make their companies more sustainable or in line with the Paris Agreement. What I do expect for companies like the ones we're talking about tonight, the more progressive, enlightened companies, is I think they need to, and you can say this is right or wrong on this better than I would know, I think they need to be lobbying very strongly for government to put in the framework which forces all companies, regardless whether they like it or do not like it, to abide by certain sets of environmental criteria. Now, we're focused on climate change tonight, so it's much easier. Now, I think there could be very clear regulations that just simply require companies to meet certain environmental or climate change commitments. So it could be the energy you use. It can only have so many grams of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour. We could have that standards for cars. We can do that. We can go for appliance by appliance. We can show how we could be delivering that today. We're choosing not to. So there are lots of things that governments could be doing. Governments are choosing and repeatedly choose not to do it. And I think there's a real role for the commercial sector, for the financial sector, to be lobbying very strongly for regulation to be, and it's clever regulation, it's thoughtful regulation to be put in place by governments that requires all of the commercial world to respond. Because I think if we're going to sit here and wait for all the companies to come to the
technical enforcement issue in this. The British government can decide that the British companies will meet target in Great Britain, but what they're going to do about British producing 80% of the goods and services in Asia?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily a problem. And this thing been arguing for a long time, and I think we start after is climate change important? If it is, things like WTO and GATT, and hopefully we'll never sign TTIP, but rubbish like that, and we have to park those things. Climate change is more important than agreements made a long time ago. So the EU could have quite clearly have standards for things that it produces, either in itself or that it imports. And if it has it, it's a huge part of one third of world trade goes into the EU. If the EU had standards on cars and on IT equipment, then the Chinese would moan and groan at first, and then they would simply deliver. They would deliver it very rapidly indeed. That would change the manufacturing base in China. That would change their energy systems in China. That means the other goods they sold to the US and elsewhere in the world.
Can you make it conditional on being able to access our markets? I mean, if you were able to say that climate change matters more than trade policy, then you would make it conditional to meet certain standards in order to get into our market. But to come back to your point, Kevin, about not waiting for each individual organisation and business to have their own private green Damascene conversion, we certainly don't have time for that because this is a really urgent agenda. So we need government to put in place a minimum floor of standards. And that is what is so frustrating because even that is not happening. So I'm not passing the buck on this. I think government has a real role to play to do that. But one of the reasons they're not doing it is because they are in hock to, for example, some of the larger fossil fuel companies who are not just lobbying government. They're inside Whitehall writing the policy now. I think we should be under no illusion about the very cozy relationship between some businesses and parts of government. I did a Freedom of Information request to the Department of Energy and Climate Change and revealed just how many people from the fossil fuel companies are inside Whitehall writing our energy policy now. So it's not terribly surprising that the policy that comes out at the end of it is not very friendly to climate. So I applaud those businesses that are going much further. I think organisations like the Aldersgate Group do a fantastic job when they do lobby government, because when businesses are lobbying government to go further, it absolutely interrupts government's narrative about this being being sort of anti-business, when you've got businesses themselves saying, wait a minute, this would be really good for our competitive advantage, it would be really good to have certainty, it would be really good for investment. You know, that is one of the most powerful things that can happen. But for all too much of the time, they are actually in hock with government trying to do the opposite.
But I'd just like to sort of flip things into a slightly more upbeat mode. It's a bit of a risk,
we'll never
isn't
catch
it, really? Yeah. No, I'm just thinking, if you dialed back like a year or two, and I spoke to a good colleague of mine, Hannah Jones from Nike, and this was about 2 years ago, we just said, things are a mess, the business community's mostly keeping its head down, the positive business community, and the bad guys are lobbying like mad. $400 million a year of funding in the US going into lobbying against climate action, shocking. And so we worked with others. We formed the We Mean Business Coalition. By Paris, there were about 400 businesses made commitments that need to be kept to account. Actually, there are mechanisms designed by the NGOs to keep them to account. I'm not saying that solves the problem, but what that was designed to do was to have this, the sort of a turbocharged Aldersgate group. So we could say, actually, the majority of leading businesses say, let's act decisively. Governments, we want you to act decisively. It's in our collective interest. We can have green growth, a green economy, green jobs, and prosperity if we go down this direction. And let's have a positive message. And have businesses step up and say, regulators, taxes, actually set the framework for a low-carbon future and do it on an aggressive time frame. And I think if you went back 2 years ago, I had a big question mark. Would we get enough of the business community to step up? There were more than 120 businesses signed up to go for science-based targets. It's incredibly bold, really. I had to even you know, when you've got someone like me in the management team of a company like IKEA, I still had to strong-arm my colleagues to say, we have to do this. So we've got some gaps where we don't know how we're going to do it, but we've said it's really important we do it. So we'll, in a publicly accountable way, make sure we set science-based targets.
I think you look.
We'd be welcome to have you on board with our.
But I think you made a very important two words there, which Stern uses and lots of other people use, and it's green growth. And I cannot see, even though I'd love to see that, I cannot see how you can reconcile that with the climate change commitments that we have. At a global level, you might be able to see it. Particularly if you want to have any element of equity around the globe. The idea that people like us can see green growth, that we can consume more cleverly and see improvements in the quality of our material well-being, I think is simply not compatible with what the science is telling us about climate change. Particularly,
more jobs in solar than coal. That's green growth.
That's employment. But if what we're expecting to see, most people think about growth is actually some improvement in their material well-being, not necessarily more time off. If we had a 3-day week, I might be quite keen on it. But so I think there are real problems if we think that we're if we try to tell people that actually if we were really clever in the wealthy parts of the world, we can actually have our cake and eat it. Mm-hmm. That misunderstands the severity of the challenge that we're facing. Particularly if we want to see the poor people, other parts of the world, they need to see growth. They need to see material increase in material consumption very rapidly in some of them. They need to improve their energy consumption hugely. That will mean more emissions in the short term. If we're serious about climate change, people like us have to make dramatic cuts. We have to be prepared to accept the fact that we will be challenging for the period of time it takes us to put low carbon energy supply in place. I hope that we can actually see some positive changes from seeing that change, that shift away from only seeing value wrapped up in the material well-being of our lives rather than actually the other sort of value-based structure that we might be able to rely on. But at the moment, I think we just have to be very clear. We cannot have green growth in the wealthy parts of the world and deal with climate change.
And I think, you know, that is summed up as well when you have the government saying so often, you know, phrases like sustainable aviation growth. I mean, what on earth is that supposed to mean? It is not sustainable. And I think the real challenge is to recognise that we need to go beyond efficiency, important though it is, and start a debate about sufficiency, which is an awful lot more challenging. But the good news is, as I think Kevin began to hint there, is that for those of us in the richer countries who are going to have to be making do with less stuff, that there's actually something potentially quite liberating about that. And that all of the work that the New Economics Foundation and others have done, showing that even when GDP have doubled, that once your basic needs are met, a doubling of GDP does not equal a doubling of happiness, well-being and contentment. To the contrary, it's, you know, tied up with all kinds of stresses and strains and not spending enough time with your family or with doing things that you like. So I think the real challenge for us is to is to reframe the debate so that it's not about shivering around a candle in a cave, which isn't terribly appealing, but it is about thinking about how can this be a liberating argument for the richer countries at the same time as precisely enabling poorer countries to be able to grow and hopefully leapfrog some of the most polluting technologies, but nonetheless to be able to grow and develop in the way that they absolutely have a right to do. But if you look at a population of 9 billion going on 10 in a couple of decades' time, then it's really clear that even with all of the efficiency in the world, we're probably not going to be able to keep on growing in the way that we have.
One quick stat on this that helps us with this. 50% of global emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, come from 10% of the population. 50% of global emissions from 10%. The top 1% of emitters in the US, and that's still quite a large group of people, the top 1% emitters, their carbon footprint is 2,500 times greater than the bottom 1% globally. So it's quite disturbing when you start to look at the basic data that tells us about where are the emissions coming from. 50% of emissions from 10% of the population, and almost all of us in this room, I guess, are in that 10% or aspiring to be there.
It might be disturbing, and I completely agree, and I think there's a lot of the perspective that both of you are presenting is out of the perspective of the Western world, us, meaning us here. Yeah. But what about these billions of people that need to sort of come out of the poverty, and what are the preconditions for them to do that? And that goes back to another question, which is fundamentally change of the economic system we have, which you talk about green growth. Unfortunately, what I can see, and I think you share that view, is that this is, we talk about green growth on the edges.
Yeah.
I mean, the machinery is still the same. I mean, we talk about fighting climate change. We haven't changed our educational models at all. We haven't changed the way how we teach economics in schools. We haven't changed the way how we teach financial economics at schools, how companies evaluate it. I'm getting, on a yearly basis, a number of financial analysts educated all over the world, starting at Nordea. And you give them something to do, and then you ask them, what is the environmental footprint of the company? And they look at you and think like you're coming from another planet. So yeah. I'm talking about, it's a fundamental, but the question is, how do we get there? You know, how we work together to get there? Is we know how it is. We know the challenges. We're aware of them. But the big question for us is, how do we get there? We have started in Nordea integrating this into all our investment processes. I tell you, it's a very painful process because on the end of the story, we talk about the financial portfolio manager's bonuses. This is where it gets, because if they're going to take a hit on sustainability issues that will be material in 3 years' time, it might affect their bonus this year. And we talk about, this is the reality we talk about. This is what happens in city here in London and anywhere in the world, because it ends up on a very, very sort of a personal level. If they're going to take pick the stock that they will deliver sustainable in a certain period of time, in 3 or 7 years' time, or if they're going to take the shortcut and do the money right now.
But the question surely is they shouldn't be having a bonus in the first place, not about how big the bonus should be.
The thing is, I'm not talking about bonuses, I'm talking about incentive models. So incentive models we have constructed in the market economy are not made for sustainability.
No, okay, yeah.
We need to change the mandate. I'm talking about mandate, about institutional capital asset owners giving us mandate to manage their money. We talk about institutional fundamental change about how we steer market economy. Maybe that will be something else in 10, 15 years' time. I don't know, 20 years' time. But we talk about something different. What IKEA does in many other companies, and I think IKEA is not stock listed. It's a Swedish company. We know them very well. I used to meet the chairman or the owner of the company a couple of years ago. Fantastic person. But I think that's still on edges. We talk about edges. It's not the core element.
Can I just say, excuse me, we'll hear from you and Catherine, and then we'd like to go to questions from the audience. So if you get your brains ticking away, please.
I'm struck in this, you know, it's fascinating. We could talk for weeks, I feel like, and still not get to the bottom of this. But if we say we want aggressive regulation to drive change on this, then can we have green growth? And we're not going to solve this tonight, but I actually think we can actually have a world of sustainable abundance that's affordable for 9, 10, 11 billion people. And it requires some big changes. I think we are going to need to see a shift towards much lower meat consumption. We're going to need to see a sort of reinvention of our agricultural systems. We aren't going to have sustainable fossil fuel aviation growing at the rate it is. So there are going to be some hard choices within that. But some things like, I think you know, in 20 years' time, energy is going to be breathtakingly cheap. And actually, people who have energy poverty today will have energy access because of things like very, very cheap solar power. And that will be a great thing for people. So I think on many levels, and energy is such a basis of this, on many levels we can have green growth and green abundance and a better quality of life. And we need, and I'm totally with you, Sasha, we need a winning narrative in this. It needs to be reality-based. Mm. So, but we need a winning narrative, which is aspirational. Mm. And most people, you know, okay, well, here we are in the liberal middle classes together. But most people are currently poor and aspiring for more. And actually, if you looked at the way people are living, you'd say, we really should help them get more as soon as possible. And we've been pushing living wage into our supply chain and across our business to try and bring that about. And, you know, but we've got to be able to do that in a sustainable way. My only real concern, where I align probably much more strongly with you, Kevin, is can we do it fast enough? Mm. So I think we can have, you know, green growth and green jobs. And I don't think it is a myth to do that. We can decarbonize growth. And we can have it on a sustainable basis. That is the mission for our generation, to secure that.
In 20 years?
That's the real challenge is, you know, is this a 2 degree? Can we do it in time? And that's where I have my big question mark, and that's where I lose sleep as well.
Catherine, I just want you, can you sort
yeah,
of come
no,
in
I'll,
and...
I'll try and kind of wrap up some of the views that I've heard. I mean, I think that, I mean, one of the stark realities that we're facing from a financial market system perspective is that we have faced probably one of the biggest financial crises we've ever seen in the last 10 years. That has not helped this debate because organizations, companies have just used it as an excuse not to act. So I'm not saying that they were blind to it. They've just said other things are more important. I have to say, I mean, I take the point about regulation, but I don't think it's the silver bullet either, because let's not forget that the banks had a stack load of regulation. They just chose to ignore it. So actually having a box you need to tick, but if you choose not to, I think we just need to be a little bit realistic about it. But I think what I would say is that I'm hopeful because of demographics and because of the fact that there is more urgency around this debate, certainly on this panel, than there ever was in the last 5-10 years. And, I mean, I would challenge all of you. I'm looking across the demographic of this room, but I can tell you, as a mother of 4 children, I have active debates with my children about climate change in a way I never had with my family, never had with my parents. You know, we talk a lot about rising sea levels. We talk about what are we going to eat. We talk about recycling. And I think, actually, that is our collective responsibility, that we need to put this urgency not only into our corporate and organizational life, we need to put it into our family life, to your challenge. What's the most important thing? The most important thing for me is that my 4 children and their children and children have a better form of existence than that which is currently looking, you know, looking down the barrel. And, you know, very simplistically at Alliance Trust, we have been an investment company for, you know, over 126 years now. You know, we actually chose to make the leap into fully sustainable and responsible investment a few years ago. I can tell you it was a tough call with our board because there was a whole sense of, oh, now you're turning into a hippie and do we all have to start wearing sandals? You know, so I think, and the answer is obviously yes. And here they are, and they're very sustainable. So I think, you know, you have to get over an element of skepticism about this. But I think ultimately it comes down to leadership. And we have a very simple mantra, which is basically that if you choose to act against society, in time, society will act against you. So, you know, that is what we practice as an organization. You know, we embed it across our entire investment philosophy. We don't have some of this and a bit of green. I mean, this is what you get. If you come and invest with us, you know that you will be investing in a sustainable future. And you will also know that your returns will be much better over time and you don't have to wait 1 million years to get them. But I think the reality is that we need to move the dialogue on. And at the end of the day, when we walk out of this door, we've all got a responsibility to do something about it, whether or not we're in government, an NGO, or frankly, you know, just a person on the street who cares about it. And I think just moving the debate beyond what isn't possible into what is possible
is ultimately going to make a real difference.
Okay. So with questions, just please, because we are a big audience and we have plenty of time, but I want to get through as many questions as possible. So please, if you're... this question is more of a comment, do self-censor, otherwise I will jump on you, not literally, and try and keep them brief. So we have a microphone and we've got somebody. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Jessie and I work for The Body Shop, and I found this debate really interesting because last night I was at a networking event for corporate responsibility managers. And I want to put this challenge to you. There are big challenges, and it does come from leadership, but you haven't thought about us in the corporate responsibility teams. We have influence over our business, and what are you doing to help us? Because if you give us the tools so we can put that business case to our CEO, and we can put that business case to our marketing managers, who are the biggest challenge, then we can have cut through. And the best example is behind you. In the marketing teams, in the communication teams, they are so scared of a scandal like that. And if they make a commitment publicly, they are so scared that the media will come back to them and say, you didn't meet your commitment, you didn't meet your target. So I just wanted to challenge you that there is some power and influence there. And also, another question, who's training the new leaders? I think your point about finance and environmental impact, how are we training the new leaders? And I know it's not going to happen quickly for us, but we need to look at business management and making sure that this is part of the business leaders' thought processes and how they run their businesses in the future. I have so much more I could talk about, but I just wanted to challenge you on corporate responsibility teams and what more you could be helping us to do to influence our businesses.
Thank you. So, Steve, I might let you answer that question about how we're sort of training people in the corporate responsibility teams and kind of influencing them. And I'd be really interested from any of you where the corporate
leaders
are.
Question for investors, I guess, because you talk about investors or companies or politicians. Who is the question for?
I put it to consumers, because I think consumers, that's what your marketing teams are worried about. That's what your CEO is worried about. And you talk about energy companies, but what about all the high street companies who are very influenced by their consumers? And I think the government regulation is another good point. I found out from my ingredients team.
We might keep it just at the...
This was really interesting. The Brazilian government, they're not great, but I just found out that if I make any products with Brazilian ingredients sourced in Brazil, I now have to pay a tax back into Brazil and into the communities of where I'm sourcing those ingredients. And I think that's another great example of how governments can be doing more to that point of regulation and taxing companies as well, and what you think about that.
But as investors, we meet hundreds of companies every year, and we meet CSR representatives, sustainability representatives, and I think the sentiment has changed from compliance-driven, like do no harm, to how is this adding value to your business. So we are working more and more in our analysis models how to identify the business case for the sustainability for each company we invest in, which eventually means that we will help you to make a business case for the board or whoever. But I have to say, after doing this for 25 years, most of the CSR people are so marginalized in the business in relation to the decision made it on a commercial level. And we want to change that, but it's taking a lot of time. And it has to do with the fact that most of the CEOs don't believe that the commercial push is that big on this, so they will need to change their behavior. They do act on this, but then the people forget very quickly.
Mm. I would just add a couple of comments. We don't have a chief sustainability officer. I think it's me. Because if I don't bang on about it and make sure that these things are embedded right through the business, it doesn't work. I think the piece of advice I would offer is, you phrased it really nicely, how do I convince my CEO? They shouldn't need to be convinced, but if they do, then I think it's one of the things that needs to be embedded as part of your objectives. What we've found is that where we had people or where we've spoken to companies where there was any real challenge around it, as soon as you bolt it into, I must do these few things in order to have done a good job, it makes a huge difference. And just very briefly on the where are we training new leaders? You should look at, there's a really great initiative that was started off in the last year, which actually we've been very supportive of, called the Forward Institute. It was started by a group of people, a global shaper from the World Economic Forum. He really tried to get about 60 people in the midpoint of their careers, so sort of typically 30s, middle management, and it's an 18-month program around exactly this sort of stuff. So have a look at it, and if you want any connection to Adam, I'd be really happy to help.
Just to add on this, I think, you know, if you can't persuade your CEO, either your CEO's unpersuadable or you're in the wrong job to some extent. Not of you. Not of saying of you. You know, you work for the body shop, but just I'll just carry on. And
we'll let,
no, I mean, I think absolutely CEOs need to, there's a leadership challenge, and it's about political leadership, it's about civil society, institutions, and business leaders that need to be there, and it's the entire C-suite and wider management of businesses that need to drive change. And we have a sort of like a small, Catherine and I were talking about this earlier, and I met with Richard Gillies from Kingfisher, who's my counterpart at Kingfisher this morning, actually, and we had a similar conversation, which is, you know, how does this mainstream? Because if you look at, we have an informal group who I will not name, which we call the CEO, CSOs, the Chief Sustainability Officers who get shit done. And it's a pretty small group there. And there's a wider dialogue with people who find it relatively disempowered within business to do it. So hopefully we're on the edge of something of a wake-up call where, and I think Paris was the beginning of a turning point where sustainability gets material for much more business. And I was actually on a panel just at the end of Paris with a colleague from the fossil fuel industry who will remain nameless, but he looked like he'd lost. And you'd had a year of the divestment movement, you'd had a huge amount of pressure. You've had an unprecedented number of head of states. Yes, the science fell short of the science, but it was still like, it was a huge political moment. It was a huge moment for humanity, for people to step up and say, we're going to try and do our best to tackle this challenge. Even if our best currently falls short of what's required, it was a massive change. And people on the carbon intensive end of the spectrum suddenly were looking like losers, not like masters of the universe. And I think that, now that in 2016, as you said, Sasha, we have an unprecedented opportunity to seize the moment and say, let's reinvent our business models and create sustainable abundance. And it's about every product, every service that we do, and every dollar and euro we invest.
Just you referred to consumers before. I think there's an interesting, again, it's interesting about the language. You refer to us as consumers. I much prefer to be seen as a citizen. And I think that one of the big problems we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years is that we no longer are citizens. We are only seen. We vote in terms of what we buy. That is not us representing our citizenry concerns. And I think unless we're going to move away from this idea of only seeing ourselves as consumers, then I think we're going to fail from this. We need to rebalance society, where we recognise the citizenry concerns that we have. And when it comes again to leadership, I think we have to be quite careful in leadership. I don't think we've got a clue how to solve climate change issues. I don't think we have any idea at the moment. And so I think we need to, it's not about training leaders, because who's going to train the leaders? If no one knows how to solve it, who on earth are the trainers? Quite uplifting in some respects, because that means rather than only having a handful of people who can train the rest of us, what it means is that actually all of us are catalysts for change. All of us could be leaders. What we know about complex systems, and that's what we have with climate change and modern society, are complex systems. It has emergent properties. We have no idea whether it's one of your children out there, if you have children, it could be your kid at home, who comes up with a bright idea that helps us resolve issues of climate change, at least partially. It may be just as likely them as David Cameron or Caroline or any of us on the panel. We are in a complex system with emergent properties, which gives all of us the power to be the catalyst for change. And I think that's a much more powerful metaphor than this idea that we have to be trained by the great and the good. They're going to train the new leaders. I just don't think we've ever got a clue how to solve climate change. So we need to look internally to ourselves rather than expecting others to show us some guidance.
I don't disagree with Kevin ever. But just to reinforce just to maybe put another slight line on it. I agree with what Kevin's saying about we're all leaders and therefore let's not get too fetishized about the trainers. But I do also take the point that the questioner put about, you know, what happens to our education, mechanisms and what kinds of paradigms are we learning in our universities and our colleges and our schools. And I do think that our chances of finding the people that are going to have that catalytic effect would be much greater if we weren't in most of our departments of economics still churning out, you know, the same kind of economic model that has been, you know, spectacularly shown to have failed over the banking crisis. An economics that still assumes that exponential economic growth on a planet of finite resources is entirely possible and unproblematic. You know, so I think that as well as recognizing that we all have the potential to be leaders, I think we could do a lot to make sure that sustainability, and in particular sustainable economics, is properly entrenched in our education establishments too. Mm.
Okay.
Question number one.
That's just one of you.
I think it's. I think it was very instructive that the. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, but not see.
I thought
yes.
It was very instructive that the person who got the only round of applause was Kevin. And his message was quite clear. We've all got a responsibility. Against that background, I kept asking myself, well, The Guardian, that's another business. I wonder what they're doing about controlling CO2 emissions. I don't know the answer, but I know what I did in order to make my little grain of sand make some impact. I stopped buying The Guardian.
I'll take that as a comment.
And in that context, there was a comment about Kevin saying, you know, what do we really value in this world? And amongst the things he mentioned was going down to the pub for some beer. Very laudable. But the riposte was, what, free beer? My recommendation to you is read Mark Boyle's Drinking Molotov Cocktails with Gandhi. Mark Boyle, who, here I must criticize myself, I picked him up in The Guardian of all places, in the money section of The Guardian of all places inside The Guardian. Mark Boyle wrote a book called
Do You Have a Question, Sir?
Then he went on to write his last piece of work, Drinking Molotov Cocktails with Gandhi. Read it, and I believe you will be convinced that we've all got a responsibility to do something about it. And incidentally, Mark Boyle, in his attempt to do something about it, has just opened the first free pub in the world in County Galway, Ireland.
Thank you. We might take a couple of questions at once, so if you have brief questions,
all right.
Please ask them.
I got a question especially for business and markets in general as we have them at the moment. How do you believe as businesses acting in this current economic market should you change in order to be a business that acts in a market that is not based on growth, an economy that is not based on growth? Because I found it quite interesting, I'm sorry I forgot your name, sir, from IKEA, you said green growth and decarbonizing growth. It has actually been proven that that is impossible. Tim Jackson in 2011 quite well argued his case economically, and I'm an economics student as well, and I needed to see the light through him as well a bit, that actually this decarbonization of growth is impossible because how you would call it is either relative decoupling, so you decouple carbon from growth, or you have the absolute decoupling, which you would be aiming for, that like we can have a growth without actually any carbon emissions. And this is impossible. We have to rethink our economic model to be a model that is not based in any sense on growth. So my question to you as business leaders, as business influencers, how do you think you can achieve that as a business, to be a business without growth? We're not at the bottom line. There has to be a profit.
Thank you. And we'll take one more. That's a great question. Thank you. And we'll take another question from here.
This question is to the investors. You mentioned name and shame and name and praise. I'm sure the business leaders are giving you a lot more information on their carbon intensity compared to, you know, the consumers, but I don't see you actually praising or shaming any of the companies. So how are you communicating that in a way that we can actually believe, considering the long history of, I would say, greenwashing, things like Energy Star and, you know, EPEAT standards that maybe have not been that convincing?
Sorry, so are you asking essentially which companies are not doing the right thing?
Not really the names. I'm sure you have some hesitations over that, but just where they're being communicated and how business leaders who are getting that information, sorry, investors who are getting that information are communicating it or are helping NGOs communicate it.
Thank you. We might let you guys answer that one straight off.
Well, why don't I have a sort of initial crack at the last question? I mean, in a shameless marketing exercise, given that Jesse said that marketing people are the worst to convince, we publish a regular newsletter. Take a look at our Alliance Trust SRI Investment Hub. We call out companies who are doing really positive things. We use case studies. We give you a lot of information about what specific thing that they're doing right, whether it's addressing climate change or water scarcity or whatever it is. So I would take a look at that. And I think ultimately, from an investment point of view, I think companies and investors are getting much better. But you're right. I think there's been a reticence to call out names. And the sad thing is, and this is exactly what Steve and I were talking about, the reality is the companies who do this really well, they're just not that many yet. So I think there's an improving list, but each company will obviously give you a position where they're talking about their future, which is ultimately what we're investing in, not for the next 6 months, but what are the big dynamics? And I think there are some real opportunities. And I think investors are getting better. I don't know, Sasha, if you've got any other observations.
I mean, coming from the Nordics, the transparency is valued as a very important thing. So if you go to an ADEA webpage, you can see the companies that we have excluded from all of our investments, companies that we engage. We were not part of the Volkswagen scandal because we did exit before. We saw the problem come. We were not part of the BP scandal. We exited BP before it happened, because we do our analysis on a longer-term perspective. And we're very transparent about that. And your question is right, because if consumers don't get information, they won't be able to make investment decisions. Just to give you an example, we've been lobbying the Swedish government once for all regarding regulations to regulate transparency for all asset managers in Sweden on ESG disclosure for all funds that are sold to all consumers on the Swedish market. And now there is a proposal at the parliament in Sweden to actually pass that law. I don't know. Hopefully the government, the sitting government, will be able to do that. But this is something that has been lobbying from our side, because we believe that this will enlighten consumers in a better way. They will provide more information, which makes them be able to invest and choose the funds that are more better from a sustainability point of view. So the governments are lobbied from industry, not only for the lack of regulations, but also for the regulations, because we believe it's actually a good thing to do. And going back to the first question, I think your question is so interesting. It's a fascinating question, because if you look at the core of the economic market economy theory, you can't have a thing like a green growth, and I agree with that. And you need to decouple completely, which means that then we need to recalculate, we need to redefine the purpose of the business. So what we're trying to do right now, and this is a very, very sort of an early stage of what we're doing, is that in Nordea we have started developing the models, analysis models, where we try to look at sustainability of businesses, from sort of a planetary perspective, if you call it, and see how is it possible to do it in that way. Is it more circular type of development we talk about? It's not growth, it's something else. It will probably mean more time, and if we have more time, we won't be consuming as much as we do. We'll be doing something else, but that will result in something else. And what is that? So we are looking at the ways how to address this, but this is the early stages. And I have to say, if you're an economics student, please ask your professors about this as well, and push that forward, because we need to change that debate. It's not existing at all right now. I mean, it's bits and pockets, but not much.
Because there are two things on the economics. One of the problems of the conventional economic system, or economic theoretical framework that we have, market economics, neoclassical economics, and those are the economics, Chicago and Austrian schools are no different, really. And that is that they have something called a discount rate. And I think the discount rate is hugely important in trying to understand the challenges that we face and why we're where we are today, even within the current model. The discount rate is broadly that you don't value things that are a long way in the future. So that's why we're most interested in what the returns are in the short term. And this applies to virtually all investments. And if you're countries like the UK, the discount rates are much higher than parts of the world like Japan, for instance, which has typically had a longer discount rate. And in fact, if you're into the Green Book, the Treasury Green Book has a discount rate of 3.5%, as the market's typically 10%, which makes a big difference. But the other way to go further beyond that is actually looking towards steady state economics. Now, this goes back to the second law of thermodynamics. There's lots of people written about this for several decades now, from Jessica Rogan right through to Herman Daly, who is someone I definitely would recommend. And steady state economics is about the idea about this idea of sufficiency, rather than necessarily just however we want to pejoratively call it, greed, which is the driver of the current economic framework. But when we think about this as well, when we think about why do we need growth? Under the current model, you need growth because there's a pursuit of productivity, which people always say is a good thing. If you have increased productivity, that means you have less people doing the same, producing the same number of goods. If you want to maintain employment, you have to therefore have growth to maintain the same number of people employed. So you have to start unpicking all these pieces and saying, well, what would that mean for our society? It might mean, in fact, we should do what Ted Heath tried to do in the mid-70s and go to a three-day week. He went for different reasons because he didn't get very well with the miners. But there are different reasons as to why we may be looking at a world where people like us have to work less hours. We consume less goods, but we have higher quality of life in that time that we have available. So we are talking about fundamentally unpicking the current model that we use to describe the world which we've unfortunately developed.
I think there's some really important points here, and that if you think like there's the Star Trek future where we work for our personal development and the betterment of humanity or something, and that's, you know, that's what we, the society we all collectively aspire towards, is that society. But, you know, from 2016, with a very urgent, if we're just taking the climate change issue, with a very urgent decarbonisation challenge, then we need to, yes, we need to move the systems in the right direction, but we also need to drive the current systems as hard as we can. And I'll come back in favour of green growth as maybe the only voice in the room in favour of it. If we look on a global basis, you know, I could say in the West, we've probably hit peak stuff. We talk about peak oil. I'd say we've hit peak red meat, peak sugar, you know, peak stuff, peak home furnishings we've hit. It doesn't sound quite so threatening, does it? Peak curtains. but if you look on a global basis, I'll come back to the point that most people are still poor, and most people actually haven't got to sufficiency. Most people are not at sufficiency, and there's a global growth opportunity. You know, the economy needs to grow. Maybe our economy, you know, actually it's a distribution issue,
yeah,
in the West.
Exactly. It's whether or not you're talking about net growth, whether every economy in every part of the world is growing simultaneously, and within that every industry, or whether there are certain parts of the globe that are growing an awful lot less fast, whether, you know, you've got green energy that is growing, but in order to enable that to grow, then that means you're not expanding airports, for example. So I think it's an issue of not just saying let's pickle everything and aspic where we are today. Yeah. It's actually about recognising, as Daly says, that there's a difference between quantitative growth and qualitative development. And I think that distinction is helpful. And also recognising, as I say, that we're not talking about every single sector of every country growing all the time. There's got to be much more of what, and another phrase is dynamic equilibrium, and all these ways of describing it. But I would worry if it meant we just need to make everything stop where it is now, because that would be massively unjust. But the point that you're making about the poverty in the world and the way in which, you know, plenty of areas of the world need growth and development, that is an even stronger argument for those of us who do have enough to stop getting more and more stuff.
There's a really interesting empirical narrative looking at this. If you plot all countries in the world and you use your best assessment of what the indices of a good quality of life are, and that could be life expectancy, health, female literacy. There's a whole suite of criteria you can use, and somebody might call it happiness, whatever you want to call it. But there's a whole set of criteria about indices of a good quality of life. You plot all countries of the world on that, and you get a very clear sweet spot of a small set of countries whose emissions are still far too high for 2 degrees centigrade, but are much more in line with that sort of way of living the world, a sustainable way of living. And those countries are people like places like Costa Rica. Now, we might question some of the political structures of these. Cuba's one of the other countries there. But they're none of the countries we normally think of. There are no EU countries in that sweet spot. And clearly, Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia, and so forth, those countries are nowhere near it. But it's very interesting when you look at that. What is it about those people in those countries that mean that every indices that we can look at for quality of life means their quality of life is better than ours, with much less consumption and much less energy use and much less CO2 emissions? So there is a really interesting empirical narrative to try to understand what is it about that world.
And they're much more equal as well. It goes back to the Piketty and Wilkinson argument, doesn't it? Spirit level. That actually one of the things that drives consumption is inequality, but that's also about that sense that those of us who are rich are still trying to catch up with someone else, and it becomes this great kind of vicious circle.
I think we'll just take one more question because we are getting tight on time, so I apologise. So do we have a...
Hello. My name's Pete Phoenix. We've been running like 25 years of grassroots environmental community centres and things. And I just wanted to, you know, a few things. The question to the panel was basically one of the themes of Paris Climate Summit was system change, not climate change. One of the reasons we occupied the Royal Mint over the New Year was to raise awareness of the critical environmental situation we face. And we really need to focus on solutions. And one of the questions to the panel, you know, all of the solutions to our environmental situation already exist. What's needed is the better networking of them and putting them out. Also, the lobbying system helps certain big corporations keep us in that business as usual and polluting as usual. So I suppose what we're calling for is, you know, environmental solution centres all over the country. We need cooperation at all levels of society, all sectors to work together. As my friend said, if we really got this together, we could create the solutions for a better future. So I suppose my question to the panel is, do you think The Guardian and other media should have a regular section on environmental, social and economic solutions? I'll be happy to open right if they want. I mean, groups like Al Jazeera have something called Earthrise, which is a constant, you know, thing about solutions for the future. So we need everyone. We can't continue with business as usual. You know, Paris was a disaster on some levels. When you add up all of the country's commitments, we're headed for a 3.5 to 4 degree rise. So my question to the panel is, do you think The Guardian and other media and other media in this room would be interested in, do you think we should have a regular column or section on solutions?
Thank you. Well, we're here under the steam of the Guardian Sustainable Business section, which is really dedicated to that. So we might take one more quick question from somewhere else in the room. Should we go with this man in the nice red hat?
Thank you for the compliment on my hat. So I just had one question, basically around the role of employees and specifically unions or other worker associations. Is there any way that the actual people in these companies not in the positions of leadership can show leadership from below? And how is that being explored in some of these leaders that make the commitments? Is it actually being reflected in, you know, someone that ships the boxes or cleans the store? So that's it.
It's a really nice way to finish.
One more.
I'm being asked to take one more question just because we're rolling. So,
good evening. I'm Nina Skrutska from the Renewable Energy Association, one of those poorer lobbying organisations for renewable energy that can't quite yet compete with the big oil and gas industries. I've got a question for you. We've talked about businesses, but how much are businesses influenced by government positions? If a country really puts its cards on the tables, will businesses flock? We've seen EY show that the UK has slipped down the investment ratings from fourth just over 2 years ago to 11th now. So is that a big influence for businesses to see that the governments are in place? I'd like your views. And two, and I think Caroline will agree with me here, We talked about not having targets. I am really, really worried that beyond 2020, there is nothing to compel a government whatsoever to continue to support renewable energy or things like that. And what is your views about that? And how can you help us, who represent renewable energy, to make that difference now?
Thank you. And we did also have David Cameron about 3 hours ago in front of the liaison committee. So absolutely, he said he totally, totally denied that this government has backslid on any of their environmental commitments.
It's good to know. Isn't it?
Just to put it in a context. So we might take on those questions first. I mean, where do government policy positions affect or allow your jobs as sustainability managers to be easier and kind of gain ground?
The dialogue we've started to have with government leaders in different places is to say, you know, we want to have a fully sustainable business and supply chain, and that we see the strategic assets of the 21st century being fresh water, air, wind, the sun that shines on us. It's the things above the ground, not the things beneath the ground, and that we want partners in government who are going to help us unlock those assets. So if they're not interested in that, then they're less compelling for us from an investment point of view. So, and then of course, and we've said, you know, I think there's a strong case for strong regulation. I'm pretty upbeat on renewable energy. I think it's one thing that's going to it's a tidal wave that's coming really. And we see with solar power getting so much cheaper, with wind getting so much cheaper, day by day. Yeah, heat and transport are big. I'm very optimistic long term for ground transportation for electric vehicles. I think it needs to move faster, and it's not gone as fast as many of us would have liked. But I think we were talking earlier about aviation and shipping. There's still question marks over there. But on the electricity side, renewable energies going to. I think we'll see. We'll realise that major, very long-term incentives for nuclear are not a good idea. There'll be wide agreement on that because renewables are so much more compelling and so much cheaper for society without the risk. So, on that I think it is hugely optimistic. So, I think the business case is already proven. People just haven't realised it yet, and some policymakers are behind on that. Could I just come back onto the question, please, from the gentleman about the role of co-workers? And everybody knows the Apollo story about the person sweeping in the toilet saying, "I'm putting helping put someone on the moon," and that's and can you unlock people in big organisations so that everybody's part of a sustainable business? And you need to do that. And we're still working on it. We've got 157,000 co-workers, and we've got a whole range of initiatives to try and empower and unlock the talents and the motivation of people in the organisation. Having people have access to products and things that can help them live a more sustainable life at home in very simple ways. You know, it can be about better, easier recycling, or making your home feel warmer, as well as technology solutions like LEDs or induction hobs. And then having we've got 6,000 people participating in that program in many different countries, where they blog and they share experience between each other about real everyday life experiences of things in a way that's been hugely educational for all of us, actually. But that's still that's the beginning for us. And I think that, you know, you do, the challenge is how do we not disempower? You know, this part of this narrative tonight is, should we just go all and get really violently drunk together in that free pub in Ireland? because it's have we got an optimistic, challenging future that we can really go for with our best efforts, or is it despair? And it's only, you need empowered people in an organisation. If you've got 157,000 motivated co-workers, you can get a lot done. So I think it's a hugely important issue that this needs to be it's a mass movement within every organisation, whether that's a political movement or a business.
Just one comment on that collaboration. I will just make it very quick on the collaboration thing. I think you're so right. We are in the beginning, we are facing the system change, the shift. The carbon thing, the CO2 emissions, just one of the symptoms of the system not working properly. So we're going to face the shift towards something that is maybe a new capitalism or new market economy or something that is different than it is today. It's going to be a bumpy road, but we will definitely fundamentally change the way how we operate business, how governments are governing not only regulations but businesses in general. And we need definitely far more collaboration on all different levels between the companies and governments. What is actually the elephant, the pink elephant in the room, is that the sovereign governments of this world are owning the 90% of all the fossil reserves on this planet. It's not 200 stock-listed companies. So the elephant in the room that these governments meeting in Paris, agreeing these commitments, will also need to fulfill these commitments by not taking what is in the ground in the countries where they are. So the governments will do their part, the business will do their part, but I think we definitely need to shift the system completely. Carbon, one thing, but there are so many other symptoms. The system is actually not. The income inequality, there are a lot of other stuff that is in the system that doesn't work. So I go for that one. I will go for more collaboration on all different levels between the different industry sectors, governments, globally, locally, in all different parts, but also addressing the system issue, not only one thing.
Come back on the, well, touch on one very quickly. First, about the sustainable sections in newspapers, The Guardian. I mean, the problem is that's a sign that we've failed. There shouldn't be sustainable sections in The Guardian. All of The Guardian should be about things that are sustainable. That's the same for all papers. I mean, if we still think we can compartmentalise off the climate, the environment, the planet, the physical place that we live, and then the rest of it is some sort of abstract world that we just talk about separately, that's a complete mistake.
You don't need to shop yet.
Yeah. I got back from Paris, I was on the Today programme on the Monday after being in Paris. The following articles after I did talked about climate change in the Today programme. The next one was on airport expansion with no thought, oh, hell, does that link us all to Paris? And then shale gas. Does that link to Paris? Of course not, because it's the BBC. So I think there are... it could be the guard. But... when it comes to collective action, I think the thing about unions is really important. Unions need to also be pushing things like pensions. And then we're doing that in the UCU within the university, because the pensions are the ones that really need to divest. Great if universities do it and the BMA and so forth, but if the pension companies start to divest, then that makes a massive impact on the fossil fuel companies. So I think we need to get the pension companies involved so unions can really be involved with that. And when it comes to renewables...
We've just got a couple of minutes.
The one number I think is really useful on renewables is that the IMF, you know, that well-known left-wing think tank, the IMF estimate, and they're usually very conservative in this, they estimate that the subsidy to fossil fuels in 2015 is $5.3 trillion. $5.3 trillion. That is more than the total world spends on health. That's direct and indirect subsidies. That's from a conservative organisation like the IMF. Renewables are far, far, far cheaper than fossil fuels today. They are just being massively subsidised. We are locked into fossil fuels for lots of other psychological reasons and for structural reasons. We're not locked in because it's economically cheaper to have fossil fuels. That's a post hoc justification of the system that we've got. And if we can get our governments to recognise that we are subsidising at massive tunes the fossil fuel industry, then we might start to, those governments might start to think that actually it would be much cheaper if they transitioned across to renewables.
So we might we might finish with you, Caroline, Catherine, if you want to just sort of...
Okay, just very briefly, on the role of the of unions, I think they're absolutely crucial, and particularly in that so-called just transition away from high energy jobs into low carbon jobs. And if that's not done in a fair and just way, then we're not going to get people on side with us on that journey. So I think that the role that the unions can play in making sure that transition for workers is a fair one is going to be really crucial, and they've done a fantastic piece of work called A Million Green Jobs, and that really demonstrates how that can happen. In terms of the question about longer-term targets, I mean, you're so right. I put a question in Prime Minister's questions last week. All I wanted the Prime Minister to do was to reiterate something he apparently had said at the European Council, which was he'd been trying to push the EU at that point, for his own personal reasons, to go for a 50% cut by 2030. And he wouldn't even repeat that because it wasn't useful to him repeating it now. So we've got such a job of work for us. I had also questions to Amber Rudd when she was talking about how we can't possibly reinstate support to solar because of the impact on the bills of so-called hard-working families. When I pointed out that the impact on the bills of hard-working families is substantially greater from the much greater and more long-term subsidies to nuclear, you know, she just looked slightly phased and moved on to the next question. So, you know, we really have to get politicians to recognise that they are not doing they're certainly not doing the environment any good, but they're not doing business any good either. And I just want to end on that point, because so many businesses have said that what they want is certainty. They want a stable policy environment so they know what the situation is where they make investment decisions. And what I think this government is doing, even in the name of supposedly being business friendly, is actually constantly moving the goalposts so that no one knows where it's going to be safe to invest. The messages aren't clear. And so, you know, when George Osborne says that we're not going to save the planet by putting Britain out of business, he could not be more wrong, because he is actually putting Britain out of business now by his vacillation over the environment and his inability to see that the green economy is actually one of the best places to invest for jobs, for enable to get out of the economic crisis that we face, as well as for getting people's emissions down.
I'm not quite sure how I follow the round of applause and Caroline's wonderful phrase to close us out. I would really say two things by way of my closing remarks. The first is a stark fact that 80% of current fossil fuels will have to stay in the ground in order for the world climate to stay below 2 degrees. That is a big number. Secondly, you know, that requires business leaders of all descriptions to step up to the plate and to take action in some shape or form. And I can tell you as a CEO, it's often lonely being a chief executive, and that's where your co-workers come into play. So I think that the call to arms that we would make as an investor is that you need to make sure that both as a corporate, in our case, and as an investor, that your responsibility is to make sure that your own corporate purpose aligns with the personal purpose of the people that you're working with. You create significant change in that regard. And I think you, the rest of us in the room, whether you're a global citizen or a consumer, however you want to badge yourself, I think we all have a responsibility to call out authentic leadership in this space. And I think that by identifying the good from the less good, that is one way that we can leave a legacy for our children that we can all be proud of.
Thank you.
Oh, I get a round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you. I think the conversation kind of went gloriously off-piste, and we didn't really answer the question in the title. So I apologise if you came along just to find that one thing out. But I think it went to all sorts of really interesting and rich places, and I hope you agree. Please join me in thanking our panellists.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.